Great. Good morning. We are a little early, and but where the panel is ready to get started here. So if council's ready, we'll go. I heard you tell our host that you aren't waiting for clients. So we'll begin. This case is court file A20 zero or dash 1099 OTI Inc. versus Ramsey County. Matters here for oral argument. All of our normal rules apply, even though we're appearing via a Zoom conference here this morning, which means both parties here will have 5 minutes or 15 minutes for their principal arguments, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. We are, as we would normally do, recording the proceedings here and posting them in accordance with our normal process. So I would ask that you identify yourselves for our record as you begin your arguments. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Rory Mattson. I am here on behalf of Relator OTI Incorporated. We're here before the court this morning on a writ of certiorari to challenge or to address the lack of enforcement by Ramsey County of its prevailing wage ordinance and state prevailing wage laws. I say that because the issue has been incorrectly framed or overlooked by the county, and that's central to this appeal and seemingly central to the county's defense. The county wants this issue to be framed as a procurement challenge. This is not a challenge to the procurement process. This is not a challenge to the procurement award, the resulting award from that process, or the propriety of the bidding in any way, shape, or form. This is a challenge to the resulting lack of enforcement that the county has failed to properly conduct. Central to this issue that the court has also already raised is jurisdiction. This is the proper venue for this appeal, for this challenge.
When you frame this issue as one of a lack of enforcement of prevailing wage laws, that seems to me under subdivision one of section 471.345 to be an action arising under or based upon the alleged violation of a law or an ordinance. So it seems like you're framing the issue squarely within the statute, which provides for original jurisdiction in the district court.
Thank you, Your Honor. And the distinction, though it may be a fine one, is that that statute, the provision that you just cited, relates to the procurement, the award, the ultimate, I guess, reception and determination of who will be doing the work itself, the procurement.
It doesn't just relate to procurement. It has it says governing procurement requirements, procurement procedures, or the award of any public contract.
Absolutely. And what the challenge here, or what OTI is challenging, is not the award. It is the performance of the contract itself. So during the course of performance, the ongoing performance of these yard waste contracts, the county is not requiring the payment of prevailing wages. So to the extent that the procurement, again, by not challenging the procurement process, OTI takes no issue with the bids, with what Utmost bid and with what Augie's bid here in the procurement process. But if that is what they bid, then they should be performing these contracts at a loss.
But I still don't understand the finer point of your distinction, counsel, because the first clause of subdivision 21 talks about a violation of an ordinance governing public procurement requirements, one of which is to comply with the prevailing wage law, which is your complaint.
So the distinction, I guess, that we're trying to identify and call out here is that it's the performance is a separate piece of the process, as in once the award is allocated, once the contract is procured, the bidding is done, then the contract begins to be performed. And in the course of performing this work, which is distinct from the procurement and allocation of the contract and determination of which entity will be performing the work. Once that contract starts to be enforced or lack of enforced, then this is a different issue. And the issue that we're raising here is that the prevailing wages are not being paid. And
maybe you can help me understand. I thought I understood that there were two parts to the contract. There was the site work where you move the brush around or whatever. And then there was the part of the contract where you haul the brush away. And that the prevailing wage provisions applied to that second part. At least that's how the county interpreted it. Applied to the second part, but not to the first part where you're just moving brush around on the site. Is that, am I right about my understanding of how the contract was framed?
That is accurate. The county did distinguish those two acts under the contract, and one of which they determined that this does not fall under the prevailing wage laws or requirements, but they do acknowledge that the hauling and that piece of the contract does fall under the prevailing wage requirements.
As I understand it, your client, and maybe I'm wrong about that, the other people who bid, their bids came in lower because they didn't apply the prevailing wage to the moving things around on the site, and your client did, but maybe I'm wrong in how I read that.
That's correct, that our OTI did apply it to, I guess, to the extent that the application distinguishes those two pieces, OTI did apply it across the board, but what's at issue is Utmost and Augie's failed to apply it in any capacity. So if you look at the addendum where I believe it's Utmost lists $90 an hour for the hauling and the truck work, that should be a minimum of 113 and change for that hourly work.
And if so, then isn't your complaint that the contract was awarded to entities that did not apply the prevailing wage to that first category as described by Judge Riley on the face of the award?
So on the face of the award, that's the bid that the county or that the bidding entity states they will perform the work at that cost. If they agree to do that, that's fine. We won't challenge that. We're not challenging that. But the county nevertheless still needs to require payment of the prevailing wage when the contract is being performed. An entity can bid for a contract and perform it at a loss. We take no issue with that. But the county is still tasked with requiring the payment of prevailing wages regardless of whatever the entity bid in order to procure the work. So procuring the work, again, is not at issue in OTI's appeal. And if Utmost or Augie's were opting to bid as they did and perform the work as they are not paying those prevailing wages. So they can bid and take it at a loss, but the county still needs to require payment of the higher amounts under the prevailing wage ordinance of Ramsey County and under the prevailing wage statutes of the state of Minnesota.
But then to Judge Frisch's point, why doesn't that go to the portion of the statute that talks about the award of the contract?
You know, because the award is proper, but it's the performance of the work. Once the work starts, these prevailing wages need to be paid. They can bid without incorporating those prevailing wage amounts. That's fine. There's no requirement that the bidding itself incorporate a prevailing wage payment. The prevailing wage notices in the request for proposals give notice to these entities that they will be required to pay these amounts. So reasonably, OTI incorporated those payments in budgeting for the performance of the work. When the work commenced for Utmost and Augie's, the entities that did not incorporate those payments, they are still able to perform the work without paying those amounts. So the reason that it's a different challenge is because the award itself is fine. There's nothing wrong with failing or choosing not to budget for payment of prevailing wages. that's a business decision for any entity that can make that decision. But then when the work itself actually begins, those payments need to align with the prevailing wage requirements, regardless of whatever the entity bid in order to get the contract. Your Honor, I believe you're muted.
What I'm hearing you say then, counsel, is that your complaint is that the county in granting or in awarding these contracts to OTI's competitors is not enforcing the minimum wage law, which seems to fall directly within the statute. I'm having a hard time seeing the distinction, I think, as the other judges are. It seems it goes directly to the claim against the county for not enforcing its own minimum wage law or the state's minimum wage law. Otherwise, what's your beef here?
That is exactly the beef, is that they are not enforcing these laws and they're not enforcing these requirements
in awarding the contracts.
But that is different, that is distinct from the award itself. They can award a contract to an entity that budgeted for less than what it would actually cost to pay the prevailing wages. There's nothing in the bids or the solicitations to receive the contract. There's nothing requiring these entities to incorporate these payments into their budgeting. That's distinct. Now, if they don't do that, and then they ultimately are performing the work and also not paying those wages, that is where our beef comes in. So they can bid, they can underbid OTI however they see fit, and that's a business decision. But once the work is being performed, the county is still tasked with requiring those payments on a day-to-day, ongoing basis through the course and entire term of each of these contracts.
But
Go ahead, Judge Flory. Go ahead, sir.
Isn't that why the statute, though, gives original jurisdiction to the district court, so that these types of factual issues that you're raising here can be litigated? I don't think the county is going to agree with your characterization that they weren't paying following the wage laws. And an appellate court isn't a place to resolve those factual differences. Isn't that why the statute gives the original jurisdiction to the district court under these types of circumstances involving the award of a public contract?
Your Honor, I completely agree that the statute speaks to the award itself and gives original jurisdiction for those instances. This is a unique situation that does not neatly fit into that statute, and it is our position does not fit in that statute whatsoever, because it is distinct from the actual award.
So the way I read the statute, counsel, is a little differently than you. So when I look at subdivision 1 part A, where it provides for a grant of original jurisdiction to the district court over any action seeking legal, equitable, or declaratory relief arising under or based upon the alleged violation of any law, which would include the minimum wage laws, or an ordinance governing public procurement requirements. Why aren't we reading that disjunctively and just broadly, given the way that the language of the statute is structured?
My interpretation of that statute is the or is inclusive, as in the procurement is inclusive in law relating to procurement itself. And again,
What's the basis of that construction of the statute? What's the legal basis for that construction?
The legal basis is the lack of, I don't believe there's a distinct separation in that, the way that it's written, as it would be a separate clause. It is the same phrase and it's incorporated in the same, the modifier is modifying procurement, and the procurement is the umbrella. So the law would fall under the procurement umbrella, the way that statute is written.
Why doesn't the or mean a law or an ordinance? Any law or an ordinance that's specific governing procurement procedures.
By reading it in that fashion, it would be open-ended and there would be no qualifier or in any regard. And what I'm trying to say is any law is any law.
But this right, is that's my point.
But then it would be, well, governing any law whatsoever in work, there's no way to tie it back to anything specific that falls under procurement at all then. So if you take away procurement, then any law whatsoever would be related, would incorporate things far beyond just wage laws, employment work. It could be absolutely anything. And right. It's our position that the procurement is intentionally included in that specific sentence to narrow it and to keep that requirement specific to procurement and not read as broadly as requiring anything under the sun that would be a legal violation of a law.
Okay, thank you.
I see my time is about done. I will save the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Mattson. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Robert Roach. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney appearing on behalf of respondent Ramsey County. The county respectfully asks this court to dismiss the appeal for lack of jurisdiction. In the alternative, the county requests that this court affirm the county's decision below because the decision is not arbitrary or capricious, unsupported by substantial evidence, or affected by an error of law. Turning first to the question of jurisdiction. The Minnesota legislature has vested subject matter jurisdiction over challenges to municipal procurement decisions, processes, and legal requirements in the district court. Based on the plain language of section 471.345, subdivision 21A, the district court has original jurisdiction over this action because the action is based on the alleged violation of a law or ordinance governing public procurement requirements.
But I mean, Mr. Mattson's argument or the distinction that he's making is that this doesn't really have anything to do with the procurement, the contract procurement. It has to do with the performance and that the county can accept the bid at a loss. But once it accepts the bid, it's required to apply the prevailing wage requirements for the performance of the contract. And his argument is that performance is not included in the original jurisdiction provision of 471.345. Do you want to answer that argument, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. That argument fails for three reasons. First, the argument fails because it's simply not true. It's not what they argued below, and it's not what they have said in writing to this court. Why are they here? Why are they upset? They're upset because they didn't get a contract. They mistakenly believe their competitor underbid them by skirting prevailing wage requirements. In other words, they're here because they have sour grapes over the fact that their competitor got the contract. If you look at the statement of the case that they filed with this court, they specifically said, the county's, and I'm quoting, the county's unequal application of prevailing wage requirements enabled Utmost to successfully underbid OTI and is the proximate cause of OTI's damage from losing the contract. And if you look at pages 162 through 164 of the administrative record, in the letter to Ramsey County arguing the administrative action that they're now appealing, their demand for relief was, we want you to rescind the contract. So their own words to Ramsey County and their own words to this court make it crystal clear. This case is entirely about sour grapes over who got a municipal contract. Second, the argument fails legally because even if Your Honors take them at their word, this is only about the enforcement of prevailing wage ordinance in this contract to which they are not a party. If Your Honors take him at his word, them at their word on that point, then they have no standing to bring this appeal. They are not aggrieved by it. They are not harmed by it in any way. There is no standing. There's no Minnesota law that allows this sort of collateral challenge to prevailing wage enforcement by a party who's not a party to a contract. If it's really about them just being upset about prevailing wage arguments, then the appeal fails for lack of standing. And third, it also fails legally, and I believe Your Honor, Judge Frisch, you referred to this. Even if the court is persuaded that this is really about prevailing wage and not the contract award, it still falls within the statutory grant of jurisdiction. The statute expressly applies to the alleged violation of any law or ordinance governing public procurement requirements or public procurement procedures. The prevailing wage requirements that they mistakenly claim we are not enforcing are prevailing wage requirements. Therefore, it squarely fits within the statutory grant of jurisdiction. So for those three reasons, the argument that this is really about prevailing wage and not the award of the contract does not salvage the lack of jurisdiction in this court. Your Honors, in their brief, I'm sorry, did you have a question, Judge Fresh?
Yeah, the construction that Mr. Mattson is arguing of the any law or ordinance governing public procurement requirements, I think the argument is that there would be no need to include that qualifying language of public of an ordinance regarding public procurement requirements, and they could just have ended, or the legislature could have just ended the statute with any law, and not have any qualifying language, so that we're not really talking about performance, we're talking about procurement. Do you want to address that interpretation?
Yes, I believe that the interpretation that Mr. Mattson is offering is simply wrong. For example, if people were double parking illegally at the work site and that wasn't being enforced, there wouldn't be an ability to bring a lawsuit under subdivision 21 because the parking requirements, parking is not in any way related to procurement. What the legislature did in this case, under my reading of the statute, is saying, If it is a law or ordinance, it doesn't matter, and it relates to the procurement process or procurement requirements, then it falls within the jurisdiction of the district court. So this is about procurement. Procurement is not limited to the award of the contract, which seems to be what Mr. Mattson is saying. Procurement includes the prevailing wage requirement. And what I would argue, Your Honor, is if all the legislature wanted to confer jurisdiction to the district court on was the award of public contracts, then they wouldn't have had added the other two clauses in subdivision A. And what I mean by that is, you know, it includes the award of a public contract, it includes public procurement processes, and it includes public procurement requirements. The legislature set out three universes of actions that are governed by this statute. So for Mr. Mattson to say, well, they really only meant the award of contracts, then what do those other two clauses in subdivision A mean? The court knows, Mr. Mattson knows, laws are to be interpreted so that every phrase has meaning and effect. And if the court interprets the statute the way he's advocating, you've interpreted away two categories of actions that the legislature has said belongs in the district court. So that's my answer to the question about the interpretation of the statute. In their briefs, they've also argued that, well, these agreements don't meet the definition of a contract, so the statute doesn't apply. My response on that is the language of the statutory grant of jurisdiction is not limited to the award of things that meet the definition of contract in the statute. It includes those two other clauses: alleged violations of public procurement requirements or ordinances, and then the clause about public procurement requirements or processes, excuse me. So the statute on its own is not limited to agreements that meet the statutory definition of contracts. In their brief, they cite three cases: Rochester City Lines versus Rochester, RE Short Company versus Minneapolis, Heard Communications versus Met Council, and they claim that each of these suggests that you do have jurisdiction. Your Honor, my response on that is those cases were all decided before the statute was enacted, and none of those cases speaks to jurisdiction at all. And each of those cases references that they were appeals from the district court. So those cases do not support the notion that there is no jurisdiction here. Their final argument on jurisdiction in their brief is to say, well, but it's a quasi-judicial decision, and therefore we can appeal it via certiorari. This flies smack into the face of the language of the statute. Section 471.345 subdivision 21B expressly states that the grant of jurisdiction to the district court applies regardless of whether the challenge is to a quasi-judicial action. Each of petitioner's arguments for jurisdiction before this court fails. It is absolutely clear that the legislature has decided that original jurisdiction for this sort of action belongs in the district court. Ramsey County.
So this, you know, this was not briefed and it's not necessarily germane to the decision that we have to make. But when I look at subdivision 21 parts D, I was curious as to whether there is still time for Mr. Mattson's client to pursue this claim in district court.
No, Your Honor. And frankly, I think it was already too late when they filed this appeal. And I think they filed this appeal saying we're going to try to shoehorn an action that we didn't timely file in the district court, because we're going to try to do something in the Court of Appeals sort of out of desperation because they waited too long.
So the procurement contract at issue was fully executed before this action was filed?
I believe it was, Your Honor. I believe so.
All right.
I will caveat that with I'm a little late to the case because I took over for a colleague who left. So, but that's my that is my belief, Your Honor. Turning to the merits, Your Honors, if you do reach the merits, then you should affirm because the county's decision below was correct. And I want to start out by talking about the standard of proof in the standard of review and the burden of proof. In its brief, Relator suggests that the court should reverse because Relator does not believe that the successful bidder or the county have adequately demonstrated that prevailing wage ordinances are being properly applied here. That argument, Your Honors, turns the deferential standard of review and the burden of proof both on their heads. Under longstanding precedent, when reviewing a quasi-judicial decision—
Mr. Roche, it appears to me that Utmost hasn't provided the documentation regarding the prevailing wage. Its subcontractor, Augie, might have.
Your Honor, and what I would submit is that what Relator is trying to do here is to, again, to shift the burden of proof and to say that these third parties haven't proven propriety. And I would refer your honors to a case called Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy versus Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And the site is 696 Northwest 2nd, 398. In that case, a third party, just like Relator's here, came along and said to the pollution control agency, you're not being stringent enough in your enforcement of environmental standards against the city's wastewater treatment facility. There was a contested case hearing below, which they lost, and then they appealed. And when they appealed, they said to this court, well, the city had the burden of proving that the more stringent requirements didn't apply. And this court rejected that argument and said, as the party challenging the action, it's up to you, third party, to prove error, not the agency or the third party to prove absence of error. So I would argue that in this case, the same burden applies here. The court should presume that the county's action below is correct, and it is up to Mr. Mattson to prove error. It is not up to me or to Augie's or to Utmost to prove an absence of error. Turning specifically to the merits, what this case boils down to is the fact that OTI is misunderstanding which services under this contract are subject to prevailing wage requirements. If you look at RC 27 in the record, it specifically says that only the labor to load and transport yard waste offsite will be subject to prevailing wage. If you look at RC 005 in the record, you look at Section D, it defines yard waste transportation. In simple terms, that means loading the waste into the trucks and driving it away. And that's clearly subject to prevailing wage requirement. Then you drop down on that same page to Section E. It talks about site yard site work. It's a totally different classification in the RFB, in the record documents. It is not subject to prevailing wage requirements because neither the ordinance nor the statute include any provision that discusses that. And then finally, if you look at the record where Relator pulls that $90 figure that they object to, and that's at page RC-143, you see that that falls under a heading that says part two, hourly work for equipment providing site work, parentheses, pushing up piles, etc. So the $90 figure that they're saying shows prevailing wage requirements are not being enforced, that clearly indicates that that $90 figure relates to work that is expressly not covered by the prevailing wage ordinance or the statute. So although we don't have the burden, I respectfully submit that the record evidence does demonstrate that prevailing wage is properly being enforced. Conversely, they certainly cannot show this court that it is not properly being enforced. Your Honor, unless the court has further questions, I'll just wrap up by saying, as I did at the beginning, we respectfully ask this court to dismiss because you do not have jurisdiction. This case falls within the statutory grant of jurisdiction to the district court. In the alternative, if your honors conclude that you do have jurisdiction, then the court should affirm because the county's decision below is correct and relators cannot demonstrate error. Thank you very much.
All right, seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Roach. Mr. Mattson, you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just begin by the definition of procurement includes the action of obtaining, the action of procuring. That is a very specific piece of the puzzle here. And
where's that? That's not in the statute.
About Merriam-Webster's definition, just the not the legal definition, the definition of the word procurement. The definition of that word is the action of obtaining. By using the word procurement, the legislature intended to specifically narrow the entire statutory body of Section 471 to the action of obtaining, the action of bidding, and the action of awarding. Now, if we actually take a look at the Minnesota state statute addressing prevailing wages, there is a whole different discussion about the contract requirements and the payment of prevailing wages. Now, by including both of those provisions in state law, there is a distinction between the award itself, the procurement under 471, and the governing process for that under 471.
I hate to sound like a broken record, but I'm still having trouble understanding the difference or the finer point of the difference that you're trying to underscore here. I mean, it wasn't a mystery that the other bidders were not applying a prevailing wage to certain of the activities that are covered by the ultimate contract in the bid. And the county award, I mean, even if what you say is true, they awarded the bid anyway. So the origin of the claim, it seems to me, arose out of the procurement process. Even if we take your argument at its face that the statute limits jurisdiction to the procurement only and not the performance. How do you address that?
Well, Your Honor, if that were the case, there would be OTI would have nothing to challenge about the bid if simply because the other entities underbid them without including the prevailing wage payment amounts. There's nothing to challenge there. If they chose to bid that amount, they chose to bid that amount. If there is a business reason or a motivation for doing that work at that cost, that is a decision that Utmost and Augie's are perfectly entitled to make. That does not excuse Ramsey County from then still requiring them to pay those wages and those amounts. So underbidding, OTI can't challenge another entity from underbidding them and from potentially paying less for the work or taking a loss, as I've said. OTI has no beef there. We don't have standing to challenge that. I would admit that. However, the challenge becomes when the actual performance is also not incorporating the prevailing wage payments. And the lack of making those payments is governed by Section 177. And under that section, there is the ability under what's commonly referred to as the private attorney general statute, but 177.45 allows attorney general enforcement, which will then bring you to the section 8.31, section 8.31, where the private causes of action are available to citizens or entities who have been damaged. Here, the damage is to those who are not being paid prevailing wages. It is beyond simply OTI. It is the laborers and the truck drivers and the truck owners who are not being paid the amount that the law requires. And again, that is something that the bid could fully incorporate and be fully transparent about, but the county is still not excused from paying those amounts when the contract begins and throughout the term of the contract. And the just to briefly touch on the substance more so here, the $90 amount for the hourly rates that are included in the addendum, if you take a quick look at the trucks that are provided there, those aren't used for hauling, and there's no question about it. Those are used for transporting waste to and from sites, and it is disingenuous to say otherwise. But this court has jurisdiction. That is why we are here, and we would simply respectfully request that the relief set forth in our briefs is addressed here, and that the county be forced to pay prevailing wages throughout these contracts. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. thank you, counsel, for your briefing and argument in the matter. The case is submitted to the court, and we will issue a decision within 90 days. Thank you. We stand adjourned.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.